KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. California's poet laureate Al Young will be joining us in the hour ahead for a discussion all about poetry, including some of his own, which we'll hear. And we'll talk about why poetry education matters with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. California's poet laureate Al Young was born in Mississippi, but has spent most of his life here in the Bay Area. He's a graduate of UC Berkeley and taught there, as well as at Stanford, UC Davis, and UC Santa Cruz. A novelist, fiction writer, memoirist, essayist, editor, and screenwriter, in addition to being the state's crown poet laureate, Al Young is the author of many books, including Snakes, Who Is Angelina, Drowning in the Sea of Love, The Blues Don't Change, Sitting Pretty, and The Sound of Dreams Remembered. His newest collection of poetry, a volume of his poems from 2001 to 2006, was recently published, and it's called Coastal Nights and Island Afternoons.
Inland Afternoons, excuse me.
Thank you, Al. Al Young served as editor of the Literature of California and the Norton Anthology of African American Literature. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Chicago Review, and the Rolling Stone, and he's worked as a screenwriter with Sidney Poitier, Bill Cosby, and Richard Pryor. He's also the recipient of Radio KPFA's 2006 Peace Award and joins us for this second hour. So nice to see you again.
Good morning again.
Well, you've been busy. Heavy as the head that wears this crown, huh?
Yes.
On tour, going to libraries, going to classrooms. It's sort of the Bob Haas approach to laureate. Huh?
Yes, that's the visible part of the spectrum. There's lots that goes on behind the desk.
Which, tell assignments. Us about it. What is that, all that?
Well, the things, West, the Sunday supplement of the L.A. Times, Rick Wartzman, the outgoing editor there, who's made that into such a beautiful publication, invited several of us to submit pieces on our New Year's resolutions. And so I wrote one for him and then received news that the budget was pulled for that end-of-year issue of West. And so he very kindly passed it over to David Ulan at the Book Review. So it'll appear in the Book Review this weekend in the L.A. Times. And my instructions were to make it more bookish.
How does one do that? That's an interesting...
If you're a writer, you can do it.
Yeah, I guess so. And you are a writer, Al. In fact, I never would have imagined looking at a book, a volume of your poetry with blurbage from California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Isn't that something?
It says, Al Young's remarkable talent and sense of mission to bring poetry into the lives of Californians is an inspiration. That's right from Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Bob Haas, former U.S. poet laureate and a Bay Area resident, says Al Young's early poems have the look of being real easy, like the poetry of William Carlos Williams and Langston Hughes. It looks like he's just out there and hitting beautiful singles one after another. Like Rod Carew came to mind. Not even thinking about poets, but ball players. I learned things about you for this hour that I didn't know. We've known each other a long time mm-hmm. and done many events together and so forth. Never knew that you learned how to read at age 3.
Yes.
And also didn't know that you'd worked as a screenwriter advisor with the likes of Poitier and Cosby and Pryor.
I spent a lot of the 70s and early 80s working in Hollywood. And it was quite an experience. As a matter of fact, that's what drove my 1989 novel, Seduction by Light. It was the classic case where the writer who finds himself at the bottom of the pecking order in Hollywood decides to avenge. And I was going to write an angry novel about Hollywood, but when I started writing it, I lost all interest in what I'd set out to do and wrote about the people that I liked most in my experience there, and that was the maids, the chauffeurs, the valets, the cooks. They're like the Washington, D.C. Civil Service. Stars come and go. Presidents and regimes come and go, but they're always there. And they were wonderful people.
It's a novel of yours I don't know. I'll have to have a look at it. I do know the novels of Frank Yerby, however. I noticed you got an epigraph from him in this collection. Talking about California, in fact.
Yes. Yes.
Just for the benefit of those who don't know, an African-American novelist who really, in many ways, was never identified much as African-American.
And that was deliberate on his part. He really did not think it was commercially wise to have his picture put on the backs of his books. But he had some smash hits in the mid-20th century.
Why did he ever? There were not. Ann Petrie comes to mind, too, another novelist who was black who wrote about Italians in Massachusetts and had some big hits. Big success.
Willard Motley was another knock on any door.
The quote we're talking about is, "Every man has his California," he thought now, looking at it, but he can't map it. Do that, he'd have a chart of the inside of his soul.
That's from a novel, a 1955 novel of Yerby's called The Treasure of Pleasant Valley.
This is a treasure, this collection, this new collection of your poems.
Well, thank you. You're so kind.
Well, I'm also being my critical self here because I like some of these poems a whole lot and wanted to kind of give people a flavor of different. Let's start with some local things. The Oakland Airport poem, I thought, would be a good place to begin, don't you think?
Sure, Dawn at Oakland Airport.
Because James Brown is in it also.
That's right. That's right.
I almost forgot that, Al.
That's absolutely right. I'll read the poem, and we'll talk about it perhaps afterwards. Dawn at Oakland Airport. Aggression keeps arriving, but almost never departs. As quiet as it's kept, greed bops along for the ride. Do you need James Brown hollering in your ear at 6 a.m. when you've gotten all of 2 hours sleep, misread your itinerary, and coldly missed the flight? I can't stand it either, James. The Godfather of Soul and all the other Godfathers share a mission this morning, and that's to put another hit on peace and quietude. You don't need no Johnny Cash, no saxophone quartet version of the Temptations, My Girl, no Goldfinger, no Ring of Fire, no Earth, Wind, and Fire doing Hearts of Fire, no jaunty disco deco from the decadent 70s. What you need is Z's and more Z's, Zambia, Zanzibar, Zihuatanejo, no Canal Zone, Area 51, UFOs, out of here, out of earshot, surely. And when two advancing armies in the war on silence conjoin, when the foreground music of Gate 10 crisses across Gate 8's background music, you know no zone can ever be demilitarized again. Green, brown, the hills that ring this East Bay underdog airport can't compete. And sky, oh lazy, hazy sky of summer, what brings you here in April? The sky is battling, too. Give us Slim Harpo. The sky is crying. Look at the tears roll down the street. Give us liberty to choose your death. The breath you hold whispers the unspeakable. Can things actually get any worse? Yes, saith Phoenix. Yes, saith Las Vegas. Los Angeles saith yes, and Houston agrees. By the time you get to Newark, maybe the Sopranos and all the electric pianos in the world will have gone on break.
Very funny. And very vital poetry, by the way. I mean, and you get that great voice of yours and the musicality that you bring to it, the rhythms and the cadences. In fact, the two things that are emblematic about this poem for me are, on the one hand, the music. And there's a lot of music in this volume. Yo-Yo Ma on a train. We've got Lionel Hampton with Love and Vibraharp. We've got Baloo's with Thelonious Monk. But there's also that sense of popular culture that has come into your work big time. I mean, it's always been there, but not to the extent I see it now.
Well, I like to communicate. That is, I like for my poems to be clear, and I don't subscribe to that school of thinking about poetry that I was immersed in growing up. I came up...
The more obscure, the better?
Yes. If you could understand it, it couldn't be that any good.
Right.
You know. So pop culture offers just endless opportunities to draw metaphors and images that speak to people.
I love when you go from Tom Cruise and Madonna to Chilled Harold. that's the versatility that I really enjoy there. I got another local poem here that I thought our listeners might like to hear about the Tenderloin. You're going to have to excise the MF reading.
Everyone knows what that means. Yes, the Tenderloin. That was written after going for a walk through the Tenderloin one afternoon after lunch with the then editor, poetry editor of the Haight-Ashbury Literary Journal, a poet and a short story writer named Conyers. The Tenderloin. Crack smokers right here in the streets, and pushers, gangsters, girls with guns, who tell you right up front, you gonna pay me, I'll hurt a MF. Daughters and kin, our sisters, these. Grown up San Francisco pure, right here where sunlight drenches hills so tenderly that liquor glass still lines streets and curbs, gutters old gold rush thugs hugged. How can this last? What corporate quirks work down to shatter and shred such bones with time's dumb pleasures? Cracked, the faces of young beauty still stand out. All these aces down in the hole, lined up to buy one cigarette at a time, one slice of bread, one slice bologna, one drumstick, one wing, they understand the meaning of a breast. That's gonna cost you. Plenitude drains into this sickness by the Pacific, a wave of nods. To touch so much as the beat of a heart counted off inside a hurried, working mouth is to reconnect with sorrow and bliss.
Very nice. The Tenderloin, that's from Al Young's new collection, which is Coastal Nights and Inland Afternoons, poems between 2001 and 2006. California's Poet Laureate spending the hour with us here on Forum. Some sexy poems here, too. The opening poem, like Butta. Isn't that the way they say it on Saturday Night Live?
Well, I think so.
But, you know, there's a lot of love here as we move from shimmering, make that shimming, and to Blackberry. Of course, I couldn't help thinking of Bob Hass's poem about Blackberry.
Yes.
Galway Kinnell has a poem about, what is it about Blackberries that draw, even Toni Morrison has a whole thing about Blackberries.
You know, poets tap into trends. For certain seasons, people will write poems about grandparents, and then it'll shift to Blackberries, and I'm not quite sure what that's.
In vogue?
Something that's in vogue. There was a period when a lot of female poets were writing poems about their genitalia. And I remember Miller Williams, an Arkansas poet. He was the second inaugural poet for Bill Clinton's inauguration.
First was Maya Angelou.
That's right. Yeah. And I was teaching, guest teaching at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, or as they call it down there, Fedville. And Miller, who collected these poems, he brought them out one morning and he said, "Now, Al, do you think if we sat around and wrote about our stuff that we could get over the way these women do?" It was just one of those moments that made us both realize that these things, these trends come and go. So Blackberries enjoyed a vogue for a while.
Actually, speaking of vogue, I remember Langston Hughes' famous remark when he was the so-called Negro Poet Laureate, saying the Negro is in vogue.
Yes. Oh, yes.
I mean, and that was certainly to some extent true during the Harlem Renaissance period, then had a resurgence of that in the 60s.
Yes.
What about now? I mean, what about African Americans now? Are they in vogue again, or are they...
Always in vogue, really. whether it's
different kind of vogue?
Whether it's visible or not. No, there's a vitality in African American culture and spirituality that will always be with us. I just came 2 days ago from the quilt exhibit at the Young Museum. And if you haven't gone out there, listeners, you have until the 31st, Sunday, to catch it. It's the quilts of the women of G. Bend, Alabama. And these are essentially sharecropper women who range in age from middle age to almost 100 years old, and it's some of the most...
We actually did a program on it, Dave Iverson, Friday did.
You know? So you know what I'm talking about. It's some of the most beautiful artwork that I've seen recently. As a matter of fact, The fellow who wrote it up for the New York Times, who reviewed the show, because it's a traveling show, he said that if Picasso and Matisse had the benefit of seeing these quilts, that their art would have been completely different. And these are women who had nothing. They did this out of pure creativity and out of the need to create beauty. And this is what art brings to our lives, and this is what poetry brings into our lives.
Well, bring into our lives maybe the opening poem here, because I say, it's a pretty sexy and
well,
love
it's also
poem.
Metaphorical. I'm getting a reputation for the poems that I write about October. Eventually, they'll all be...
You'll start a new vogue with October, maybe.
Well, maybe. But I think I've been already preceded by many other poets. Eventually, I'll issue a volume called The October Variations, which will encompass all of them. Like butter. Excuse me. Like butter, your body against mine, spreading, sliding up and down, melting the way toast desires, the way heat dictates, and grain be jammed. Just you, just you, let's talk about you. The hot, smooth comfort of you tastes easy to bring back in spring, but summer bums us out. October, you cool every fool persistent in her folly who turns wise. Crossed off everybody's list, your kisses go gold, go platinum, go broken-hearted. Big, haunted heart, October, where do you go? Where do you hide while every other season seeds its need? Where do variations go to hide? Which side of tomorrow, which side of tonight will we turn to see if you are burnt or brown and crunchable? Who are you that you prompt such ready poetry? Your hands at my back in a hug already famous. Kiss the butter from my lips, October, toast us.
Ah. Joie de vivre.
I see what you mean.
Yeah. The autumn of our lives, huh? Getting back to African-American themes, you've got a lot of, well, you got a Grigri poem in here. You got a lot about the blues. I mean, the blues have obviously had an enormous effect on you. And there's a sense of, always been a sense of strong identification for you as an African-American poet and as a California poet. What about when they try to claim you as a Mississippi native son?
They do that. As a matter of fact, in February, I'll be traveling to Natchez, the University of Mississippi at Natchez, to receive the Richard Wright Award for...
Oh, congratulations.
...excellence in American literature. And I'm very tickled and surprised that that'll be conferred on me. They have no problem. You know, Mississippi claims all of its people.
Including Richard Wright. Who
That's
would have
right.
thought, huh?
That's right.
I mean, I remember in was it... I think it was in Uncle Tom's Children, or maybe could have been his autobiography when he writes about going to a library in Natchez.
That's in Uncle Tom's Children.
It's in Uncle Tom's Children.
I think it's in Uncle Tom's Children.
He went the whole thing with the stone throwing and all that.
Yes.
And he writes about going in there and taking a note in because he wanted to read Mencken.
He had to take a note from his employer. You know, we're putting it politely, his boss. And it said, give this little colored boy...
I think it said the N-word, actually.
Yes, it did. I'm being nice. some books.
Well, give him a copy of Mencken. The thing was, he forged that note, I think.
Yes, I think he did. Yeah.
You know, and in order to read
and,
Mencken...
And as I recall, he took out a book, a collection of essays by H.L. Mencken called Prejudices.
That's right.
And he was attracted by the title. And he thought he'd never seen a book called Prejudices before, but he knew what it was.
Well, it was one of those things that was verboten to even talk about back
yes.
in those days in Mississippi. You get political in this volume. I mean, you know, you've been always a political poet. I'm thinking of a poem like A Low-Flying Blues for Somebody, which is pretty political.
Yes.
And Notes on the Future of Love is pretty political, too. As you get toward the end of the volume, you get more political, maybe. You want to read one of those?
Let's try one. A Low-Flying Blues for Somebody, which opens with an epigraph from Gary Snyder, his first volume, which has become a classic, which was called Rip Rap. And he draws upon his merchant seaman days and the line that I excised from one of those poems, T2 Tanker Blues, is, whoring my hands and back to move this military oil.
That mellifluous voice of yours, Al, is getting a little...
Yes. I think I'll have some water.
Grab some water here, and then, again, this is going to be a low-flying blues for somebody.
Somebody. In these hard and hardening times, poetry looks and sees and then becomes an honest way to go. To speak to one another rather than get talked to listen to one another rather than one announcer, to look out and see one another rather than be watched and spied upon, and to touch and hold one another rather than be handcuffed, imprisoned, and shot. What horrific differences. The unpublished picture of a young, now legless GI mother scrambling on the floor with her 3-year-old daughter, the Rock of Gibraltar, the Rock of Iraq, might make a defense secretary or a secretary of state or a vice president or an attorney general crack up secretly in laughter. To rule the world, you need some oil, crude but blunt and right to the point. Cut to the Chase Manhattan of it, barrel house the Bundesbank. Picture bales and bales of $100 bills bundled up in Latin America's and others' jungles, mildewed, rat-gnawed, pondering its own laundering. In these hard and hardening times, poetry steps out and brings back the deadest of giveaways, the cleanest of getaways.
And another celebration of poetry, of course. But I like, you know, when you're talking about such serious stuff and you get into this, it's almost unavoidable for you. Cut to the Chase Manhattan. I mean, these kind of puns, pondering its own laundering. I mean, kind of rhythm.
I can't help it.
It's splendid stuff. By the way, I got an email here from somebody named Leonard who says, before he was a writer and poet, a very young Al Young was an appealing solo entertainer. My then wife and I spent many cozy evenings drinking jug wine and listening to Al accompanying himself on the guitar in a very dark post-beat pre-hippie club on San Pablo Avenue called The Blind Lemon. Later, I recall hearing him play occasional gigs in a long-gone Hofbräu restaurant on College Avenue in Berkeley. Maybe be willing to talk about how those activities helped shape his later work, which I have followed through the years. And this is from Leonard, who signs himself still in Berkeley.
Oh, boy. Well, it's all true. I put myself through college, actually, playing the guitar and singing. And when I came to Berkeley, I had $7 in my pocket. I came out from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I went into Robbie's Cafeteria on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, and I took out my guitar and I started playing, and some guy said, "You're good." He said, "Let me take you over to KPFA and get you on the air," because they have this show called The Midnight Special. Well, it was too late to do that, but I got a gig the very next day and found a place to stay, and all on the basis of being able to sing and play the guitar.
You were singing what kind of songs?
Folk music. Yeah. Folk blues and standard folk fare and all of that with my own little twist. And music has always played a big part of my life. Before the guitar, I had played tuba and trumpet and baritone horn.
I was first introduced to you through Snakes, which is very much about music.
That's my first novel, yes.
Yeah. We're going to open the phone lines talking to Al Young. You may want to join us in conversation with him. May want to talk about poetry and what it means to you and poetry education, how important it is, because now he has been crowned California's Poet Laureate. We welcome your calls. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, the number you can join us at right now is 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, and Al Young's new collection of poems is called Coastal Nights and Inland Afternoons. When we return, your calls and emails. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, spending the hour with Al Young. And in fact, you can read his new volume. It's out and available, Coastal Nights and Inland Afternoons, poems from 2001 to 2006. We were able to hear some of those poems here in the first half hour. He is California's Poet Laureate now and has been here in Northern California for many years as a professor and as a acolyte as well as a evangelist of poetry and getting people to realize the importance of it, poetry education. In fact, Al and I have been involved in a number of good causes through the years together, including doing a world literacy event a few years back, and it's calling to my attention a story that some of you might have seen in a recent chronicle about illiteracy reinforcing the captivity of prisoners and having an effect on them, their inability to really communicate because of illiteracy. It's also a sense of maybe ameliorating illiteracy through poetry.
I mean, yes.
This is often done, in fact.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'm convinced that you could teach kids to read in a jiffy if you were to put text on tape in audible format and just have them hang out with, you know, show them how it looks on paper. I think they'd pick it up very quickly because a lot of people are very smart, but they simply did not have the advantage that I had of having parents who were eighth grade graduates, but nevertheless read, and they read to us. And because they read to us in a loving way, you know, you sit in your parents' lap and they put their arms around you, it makes it easy to learn to read.
Associated with that kind of security, comfort, and affection.
I think so.
Yeah, it becomes almost Pavlovian, doesn't
yes.
it, in some ways.
Yes, I think so.
Let's bring our callers on. Sugar Ray, our first caller. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Hi.
My name is Sugar Ray Robinson II. Obviously, Sugar Ray Robinson was my dad. But we started an organization called One World, One Race Human, and are committed to bringing equality and brotherhood back into urban settings worldwide.
Yes.
And I'm so thrilled because poetry is the way to do it. It's so great.
I think somewhat. So.
So I just laud what you're doing, and it's such a pleasure to be able to speak to you.
Well, bless you.
I was, of course, an admirer of your father, one of the great pugilists of all time. Where are you, Sugar Ray Jr.? Where are you?
I'm in San Francisco right now. Uh-huh. My son opened up a company called Gold Coin Clothing here in San Francisco. So we're getting to do a whole bunch of things. And my book is out, which is Sugar Ray Robinson, Pound for Pound. And there's another book coming out called Being Sugar Ray in February, which, by the way, Al, is the only time publishers let you release an Afro-American book is in February. Sounds kind of like a conspiracy.
But my Black History
came out 2 years ago in February, and this new book that's coming out, which is called Being Sugar Ray Robinson, is coming out in February.
Oh, my goodness.
So
what did you think about the musical group calling himself Sugar Ray?
Oh, it's wonderful, because the guy who started the group, and I can't remember his name right now, was on a show one day, and someone said, oh, you named your group after Sugar Ray Leonard? He said, no. No. I named my group, this group, out after Sugar Ray Robinson, the master. And I said, all right, brother.
Was your dad a lover of rhyme and poetry like Ali? Or?
Well, if you've ever seen my father box,
I have.
Then you know he was a lover of rhythm.
Yes. He also he also was a performer out of the ring.
Yes. My dad retired for 2 years, and we lived between Cannes and Paris. And I have some of my most luscious memories in life of those days.
Oh, my
goodness.
But
the whole idea of books coming out in February, anything African-American, you can only do it in February. You can't do it it's got to be February. Couldn't be the 4th of July. It's got to be February. So...
Well.
What is interesting to me is that during that month, I'm doing a full court press on doing everything about that. Also, this is you. I want you and your listeners to know, Dad and James Brown were what a Filipino woman told me once is a birthday buddy. Same date born, not the same year, but the same date.
Ooh.
And both being from Georgia, it's real interesting. I'm thinking of going down with Sharpton to be at the funeral.
I think you should.
Yeah. Well,
I have to ask one last question before we we move on. Did you ever hear the recording that Babs Gonzalez did in tribute to your father?
Yes.
Called Sugar Ray?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
My mother was, her first job out of high school was the featured dancer for Duke Ellington's first tour to Europe.
My goodness.
So it's interesting. All those people, all those names, all are part of my growing up.
Well, a very rich growing up.
You're very
up.
Fortunate, yeah, man, and we appreciate your calling here and joining us this morning.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having Al on, because he is a stand for literacy that needs to be carried out.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
On we go. We go to Berkeley. Banjay, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to
good
both
morning.
Of you.
Hi.
Yes, this is Banjay Canonizado Buell.
Hi, Banjay.
And hi, Al. It's just wonderful hearing
this is an
you
author.
On radio this morning. I'm home sick in bed with pneumonia.
Oh, my goodness.
So, anyway, this is wonderful to hear from you. And I just wanted to say that I am looking forward to your presentation at International House on February 1st.
Yes.
And you will be making a presentation on poetry, globism, and human survival.
Is it February 1st or February 5th?
It's February 1st, I believe.
Oh,
if it doesn't sound like me, Al.
If it is, I'm
check
in trouble.
Your calendar.
I think it's the 5th.
I can double check for you.
Okay.
And April's going to be tough for you. I mean, February is tough for blacks to publish. April is tough for you because you're going to be doing all these schools,
yes,
libraries,
yes,
fairs,
poetry month.
Poetry
wow.
Month, yeah.
And it's also Jazz Month.
And I also want to congratulate you on your new book. And I also wanted to mention that I am so appreciative of the endorsement you made on my book.
Would you tell our listeners the amazing title of your book and what it's about?
It's the 25 Chickens and a Pig for a Bride.
That's right.
Growing up in a Filipino immigrant family, and right now it's doing very well in Berkeley, we're still trying to get it out into the broad community.
Well, you should send a copy to us here at Forum, and we'll have a look at it.
Oh, wonderful.
Sounds like
I'd love
would
to do that.
Be of interest, and we thank you.
I can get your address.
It's a wonderful read, and it's very funny and at the same time very deep and sad.
Yeah, just send it to Forum at KQED Radio. That's 2601 Mariposa here in San Francisco, and I thank you for the call, and we'll get on Steve next. Steve, you're on.
Yeah, can you hear me? It sounds like we're rather distant all of a sudden, but never
hear you just fine.
Okay, great. Al Young came to my son's high school about 10 years ago in San Rafael, and he comes home, and he'd been reading poetry. He liked it all right. It was kind of interesting, so forth. But here he was jumping up and down. He said, Daddy, this is poetry. If this is poetry, I love it. He's so alive. And he just could hardly contain himself. And as I'm sitting here listening to you read your poems, they remind me so much of the rhythm and the cadence of E.E. Cummings. I don't know if that's a comment anybody has ever made, but
he's one of my favorites.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for
thank
the call.
You.
Also, you know, Cummings was much more of a punster too than
yes.
You remember that poem of his, "Pity this busy monster
man unkind." Yes,
man
I
unkind.
Do.
By the way, if you'd like to join us with Al Young, we welcome you at 866-733-6786 or by email forum at kqed.org. And heard some of the poems from this new collection of Al's, which again is called Coastal Nights and Inland Afternoons. It's a versatile collection, and you told me there were a lot of that you had to kind of put on the cutting room floor. How do you decide what to put on the cutting room floor?
Well, the editor at Angel City Press in Santa Monica more or less decided. We argued about a couple of them, but she rightfully pointed out that you want all strong poems, and some of the poems didn't have the daring do quality that the ones that were included.
Aren't you lucky to have an editor that you can trust with that kind of judgment? Yeah,
she's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I've got one that. Now that I compare to both Maxwell Perkins and Jiminy Cricket. Because in a sense, it's not only the Perkins ability to tell you what works and doesn't work, but the Jiminy Cricket conscience functioning as well on that score. There's a sense of the importance, again, in your work that you've alluded to of music, and you had mentioned your own background playing the guitar and a number of other instruments and when you're writing poetry, are you listening to music? Is music a part of the whole kind of mood that's created for you?
I'm listening to music in my head these days. In my earlier years, I'd say in my 20s, 30s, and about halfway through my 40s, I listened to music while I wrote. But music is not just something in the background for me, which is probably made obvious by that poem Dawn at Oakland Airport. It commands attention. And I'm drawn into it, and so it becomes a distraction. And so I'm perfectly happy now to have music in my head while I'm working. And that affects the cadences in the poem.
Well, the poetry becomes its own music.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, we've got a whole schedule here of where you're going to be reading, so you don't have to, you can get that out of your head now. You don't have to worry about that anymore. We'll bring it up at the end of the hour. Meanwhile, I want to bring up some more emails. Robert of Carmichael says, your line about Cut to the Chase Manhattan reminds me of Gil Scott-Heron. Any connection between you two, he wants to know?
Well,
you know
Gil Scott-Heron actually was a poet before he took to writing music.
Father of rap, some say.
Yes. He wrote a book called Small Talk at 125th in Lenox, I believe was the title. And after that, taught himself keyboards and went into singing his work. I've always admired him, and I think he's quite a poet.
Here's Phil who says, please ask if Al Young holds any feelings yet for his boyhood Detroit. Friends still there, family, trips, and any observations from those trips. Loyalty to the Tigers or to Oakland A's now? Now, this is from Phil who says, also Detroit boyhood and great friend of your Detroit memoir, Snakes.
Yes. I belong to a rather large community of ex-Detroiters, and we talk about Detroit all the time and email and by telephone. I get back to Detroit quite often. In fact, I'll be there in March to do a performance with Kenny Cox, the great pianist, and a jazz ensemble there. That's another side of me that people don't know enough about, although I've been performing around the Bay Area and around the country. But I not only recite poetry with jazz groups, but sing also with jazz ensembles.
Your extraordinary versatility is also emblematized by your regional identifications. You've got Mississippi, Detroit, the Bay Area. You got anything up in the Northeast?
No.
Montana?
Really.
No. All right. I just want to cover all bases here. Here's Tom who says, recently heard Mr. Young read his poem about sitting in the Oakland Airport. What great work. Thank you, Mr. Young, for pointing out the dearth of silence in our society and how we're constantly under assault.
Is that Perry Thomas, the great writer? Was the name Perry Thomas, did you say?
No, this email?
Yes.
From somebody named Tom.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Perry Thomas, down these mean streets, yeah.
Yes.
He's still around, in fact.
Yeah.
Let me get your calls. Mary, good morning.
Good morning. I'm very interested in your conversation, and I've been a writer most of my life as a journalist, but hadn't really turned to poetry until this Christmas when someone gave me a copy of Savage Beauty by Nancy Milford, mm-hmm. about the life of Edna St. Vincent Millay. And it occurred to me that a lot of people would be drawn to poetry by knowing a little bit more about the lives of the poets and how their creativity is born and that sort of thing. So I wondered if you had ever thought of sort of incorporating your own biography in with your poems.
I've written my share of autobiographical poems and memoiristic poems. I'm currently in rebellion against what's called a confessional mode, unless it's done imaginatively. If you look at the preponderance of American literary poetry now, you'll find that most of the poems are written in the first person, and they're about the poet quite directly, or seemingly directly. And when I teach poetry, I teach my students to be wary of this obsession, that if you use the first-person voice, you should mix it up sometimes and not let it be literally you, because the first person is a social construct, and to that extent is fictitious. But I think that by studying the lives of poets, you can learn a lot about the nature of poetry and the effect that it has on us as living organisms. I'm convinced that if you read poetry to your pets, you'll get a reaction that will be very surprising, because we're talking about musicality and rhythm, which takes the form of language, but it's a lot more ancient than we like to think.
Confessional poetry, which, you know, I remember Garrison Keillor on here saying, why do people have to categorize, he was talking about Elizabeth Bishop, why do they have to categorize poetry as confessional? And he was objecting to the whole notion. But, you know, early Plath and Lowell and Ginsberg, they're all confessional poets, Barrymore.
You have to keep in mind where that term.
It's a persona, though. I was going to say it's not necessarily one on one. This is me in the poem.
That's right.
You said it's like a fictional self often. Yeah.
Right, and it's being voiced in a puritanical society that is supposed to be shocked by these revelations. You know, the shadowy side, the dark side of the poet's makeup. That's really what characterizes so-called confessional poetry.
It was designed, some of it really, to be shocking. And
yes,
it was in a period when breaking out of the, well, I guess Lily Tomlin called it the foreplay of the 50s or something like that, the liberation. Let me get to more of your calls here. And
Savage Beauty, by the way, is a wonderful book. I read that book on Edna St. Vincent Millay, and I was shocked to find out some things about her that I didn't know before.
Yeah. She was a beauty.
She was a beauty.
Yeah. And Elizabeth, join us. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, in going to the schools, you often encounter, I'm sure, non-native speakers of English. How do you work, or do you work in any special way with non-native speakers of English and poetry?
I don't have to work in any way. We play. It's wonderful when I run into non-native speakers of English, as you term them, because they're learning language. They're bringing their experience from one language into another language, and people forget that language is more than just words. It really is experience. And I can remember being in Los Altos. Los Altos High School had an arts festival, and they trotted me around for two or three days to just about every class in the high school. And at one point, my teacher guide took me to an ESL class, English as a Second Language. And she said, well, these are not our sharpest students. Many of them, you know, they're from Vietnam and from Cambodia and from Mexico and from the Middle East and Africa. And they might not understand what you're talking about, but we don't think that they should be denied exposure to you. It was the best. We had the best session in the world. I read a poem, and a guy who was dozing in the back, he looked up. He got up on his elbow, and he said, yes, we have this in my country. and they all came alive, and they just started uttering things, and I encouraged them to recite poems, you know, in their native language, and try to explain what it meant in English and all of this, and it was just a marvelous hour.
It just demonstrates to what extent poetry is a universal language.
Yes.
Brings up a question from one of our listeners, which may be a bit heavy and metaphysical, but Andrew writes, what is the difference between poetry and prose?
For me, it's musicality. Music makes the difference. That poetry has a musicality to it that encompasses both melody and rhythm and sound. And the further we drift from that musicality, the more prosaic things become. The language that we're accustomed to now, received language, is one of the big enemies of our development as a species. I think it's crucial now that poetry be brought to the forefront, and it is at the forefront. There's never been such an outburst of poetic activity across the planet now as is occurring as we speak in just about every culture, because poetry is still one of those outlets that enable people to say what they want to say without being mediated. And a lot of contemporary literary American poetry is very prosaic. It's as if someone took pages of prose and just chopped it arbitrarily to make skinny lines.
It's almost rhetorical, really.
Yes. Yeah. And the kind of received language that I refer to, not to let that thought go, when we talk about enemy combatants or we talk about collateral damage or any of these phrases that we get from official speak, I heard one this morning that just blew me away. They were talking about a meeting that's taking place at the White House on new strategies for that America is coming to for on how to conduct the war in Iraq. And it said that the meeting today will be non-decisional. And I thought, decisional? You know, is that...
Non-decisional.
Is that to keep from saying decisive?
Well, you know who the decider is.
Yes.
He's already announced that fact, our chief executive.
When we take terms like this, when the vice president tells us, for example, that the men and women who are dying in Iraq are dying for a just and noble cause, then you have to ask the question, what does a 10-year-old who hears this language think justice and nobility are about? And that's where poetry comes in, because it freshens the tongue again.
You probably remember a book by John Chardy called How a Poem Means.
Absolutely.
That always struck me as getting to the essence of what poetry is. It's not what something means, but how it means. It's the process of the poem. It's what's communicated in figurative language as opposed to literal
That's
language.
That's right. That's right.
Some more emails. Carolyn says, I would encourage your listeners who are older adults to try writing poetry. I teach a writing class to older adults in their 60s through 90s, most of whom already like to write, but who are surprised to find they enjoy writing poetry. Others who write fiction or memoir are inspired by and get ideas from reading poetry. Many adult schools in California have writing courses they can join, some specifically geared toward the 50-plus group. I've been reading Mae Sarton, Coming into 80, which she wrote in her 79th and 80th years of life, and enjoying it greatly.
And to free people up in that pursuit, keep in mind that though we think poetry is about personal expression and subjective experience and sentiment, it can be really about anything. In fact, I love, for example, the science poems of people like John Updike. People don't know that John Updike writes poetry, but he's written some poems on science that really clarified, you know, the nature of math and physics and chemistry and this sort of thing.
Another one of our listeners from Santa Rosa, Suzanne, writes, thanks for the great program with Al Young. Has new technology or social networking sites like MySpace and YouTube helped the cause of poetry? Are you seeing any new trends of how poetry is being published due to digital advances? And are there royalty or rights issues that need to be navigated?
That's a lot.
Those are all three programs in themselves, I think. But certainly it's changed the dissemination, to use a heavy word, of poetry, because anybody can express themselves now in the Internet
yes.
and do so in poetry.
Yes, and they do.
Just like in blogs and all the rest of those
things. I find it interesting that at the time that the United States invaded Iraq, one of the things that annoyed, reportedly, Saddam Hussein was that it interrupted the completion of his third novel.
Yeah, you wonder about, you know, I can't help thinking about the frustrated writer like Saddam Hussein or bin Laden, who was also, you know, writing poetry, wrote a poem after the USS Cole attack about the delight he had in those bodies being exploded into the air in different pieces and stuff. Maybe they're just, you know, they get homicidal from not having their work published or recognized, you know. Not the old Leroy Jones theory. Mary, join us. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. This is I believe that emotional vocabulary in young boys can be helped with poetry. I don't know what you think. I know it was the case for my own son, and he published a book. It was reviewed in Perry Match. We live in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And my request to Al is that I'm on my fourth edition of a publishing house where all the proceeds go to different charities that the kids pick. And we live in Europe, so it's 139 nationalities in the last book.
Ooh,
on
wonderful.
Water. And the money goes to water wells in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Would he be willing to work with Ustinov Foundation, the son of Sir Peter Ustinov, and do the preface of the next book on prejudice?
Well, little did you know, Al, that you came on, you'd be solicited another writing project. But.
Why don't you email me and remind me?
Okay.
If you go to my .gov site.
Okay.
That's the Poet Laureate site.
It's www.cac.ca.gov. Yeah?
Yes.
That's the website.
And the CAC is California Arts Council.
Right. So people know. So tell us about, thank you, Mary, for that call.
Thank you.
Tell us about meeting the governor. How was that?
Which time?
Well, let's start with the first time you met him.
Well, the first time I've talked about this on numerous occasions. I was surprised that he took the pain to memorize part of one of my poems, an unlikely poem about prison reform called Conjugal Visits. And the last time I saw the governor was this summer in Sacramento, posing for a photograph on the steps of the Capitol. And he brought his African-American appointees together on the steps. He's appointed 126 African-Americans to positions in his administration, and I'm one of them, and about 85 of us showed up, and he had a reception afterwards, and he addressed us all as y'all. He said, so wonderful to have all y'all, have all y'all here. You know.
Y'all. likeable chap, I'm told, by people who have met him. We've not met him. We've certainly invited him, but amicable.
And, quite charming, yes.
Yeah. And then you have that whole sense of his presence on the screen that kind of colludes with the reactions.
Yes. Oh, yes.
People are probably curious. How does one get named Poet Laureate?
You know, it's an intricate process. I think this began with about 300 poets being considered. And I've been told that people would come up and they'd say, I voted for you. And I said, where did you vote for me? Well, poets and writers invited people to write in. The California Arts Council, under a committee that was headed by Robert Haas, the former Poet Laureate of the United States, they screened the nominations and made recommendations. It went on for a couple of years before it trickled down to four people, which I was one.
Well, again, congratulations. Delighted to have you with that august position. And speaking of positions, those of you who are interested in hearing Al read more of his poetry, he's got an event coming up January 7th at Cafe Solo with editor Glenna Luseski. That's at the Artists Union Gallery at 330 California Street in Ventura. And he'll be up in Petaluma. I'm looking for that.
That might not have made it down to
the schedule. I don't think it was on the website. So let's give out the website again, and you can find out about
that. I'll be at Copperfield. No, go to Copperfield's website.
All right. If you're in Petaluma, go to Copperfield's. Better yet.
And we're going to straighten this out on the our website.
Glad to have had you here, Al. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Michael. It's always wonderful.
Coastal Nights and Inland Afternoons. Excuse me. That's infectious. I got it in my voice now. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our interns, Elsa Chang, Barton Kreeth, Negar Gobadi, Mike Fisher, Mary Trell, and Leah Wellborn. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.